The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's wonderful to be here again with all of you, with familiar faces, with new faces. So how many of you are here tonight for the first time at IMC? A show of hands. Who's here for the first time? Nobody. Am I missing? Am I not seeing it? Any? No? Wow. No newcomers. Wow. Should be better. Do better with newcomers. There's always hands going up. Anyway, so welcome again. So I'm Nikki Mirgafori, and many of you have seen me before. So thanks for not reading my long bio. So what I wanted to talk about tonight and share tonight is something that has been very inspiring to me, and often Dharma talks. Dharma teachers give Dharma talks based on what speaks to them. You know, there's no rule. You have to talk about this and this. Well, actually, there sort of is, but I'm going to talk about something, a sutta that's really speaks to me and also I'll relate it to... Well, actually, let me tell you what the sutta is. So it's the acrobat simile. It's the simile of the acrobat. And it really relates to daily, to lay practice, I would say. Both to practice on the cushion, but especially to lay practice in community, in relationship to others. Either a close partnership relationship or just relationship to others and the world. And I would also like to relate it to something else that I was reading and thinking about recently, which is a book on secrets of great relationships. So I think there are many commonalities that I saw between these two. And just to say a word about the secrets of great relationships, and I will talk more about it, a couple of psychologists talked to more than 100 very, very happy couples, and they tried to distill what their secrets were, and they came up with 16 things that were common to these relationships. So I'll draw parallels. Okay, now I'm just trying to. This is a teaser. I'm trying to get you interested in the talk. Okay, so with that teaser, I also want to give credit to Bhikkhu Analayo, whom I sat with at IMS for 2 weeks in March, April, sometime this year. And he actually, he's a very inspiring monk. He's a scholar, he's German, he teaches Buddhism at the university, and also he's a very intense and dedicated practitioner. And basically he was in the hall practicing the whole day with the retreatants. And the reason why I would like to give credit to him is that he's the one who brought up, who mentioned the simile of the pole acrobats during the retreat first, and he talked about it a little bit and really piqued my interest. And also he's written an interesting paper analyzing it, and much of this talk is based on the paper that he's written analyzing the sutta. Okay, I've given my credits. All right. So the sutta really relates to taking care of oneself and taking care of others. In fact, the title of the paper that Bhikkhu Analayo has is Protecting Oneself and Others Through Mindfulness, the acrobat simile in the Samyutta Agama. So the sutta really has to do with taking care of oneself, with protecting oneself and protecting others. And actually, let me just read the sutta first. It's short, it's sweet, and then I'll talk about it more, and then we can discuss it. So thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was dwelling among the Kosalans in a Simsapa grove near the town of Seraka. At that time, the Blessed One said to the monks, "In former times, there was a teacher of acrobatics done in dependence on a pole." Basically, pole acrobatics. He placed the pole straight up on his shoulder and told his disciple, "Getting up and down on the pole, you protect me, and I will protect, you protect me, and I will also protect you. Protecting each other, we will put on a show and gain much wealth. So basically, the teacher is telling his disciple, you protect me, I protect you, we'll both be protected. Right? Simple. Got it? So each protects the other person, therefore, you're both protected. Simple, clear? I can move on. Okay. Then the disciples of acrobatics said to the teacher of acrobatics, it won't do. Okay. Why not? It won't do, as you said. Instead, we should each take care to protect ourselves. Like this, we will put on a show and gain much wealth. We will be physically at ease, and yet I will get down safely. Huh. Now, the teacher of acrobatics said, as you said, we will take care to protect ourselves. This is correct and is also the meaning of what I said. So now the teacher is saying, oh, actually, you're right. We should each protect ourselves. And this is what I meant to tell you. Okay, now let's see what the Buddha says. The Buddha said, having protected oneself, one right away protects the other. Ah, wow. When protecting the other and oneself, this is protection indeed. So let me read the line of the Buddha again. Having protected oneself, one right away protects the other. When protecting the other and oneself, this is protection indeed. So basically, the Buddha is agreeing what the disciple says. And let me continue. So how does protecting oneself protect others? Becoming familiar with one's own mind, developing it, protecting it accordingly, and attaining realization. This is called protecting oneself protects others. So let me repeat the main part of it. Becoming familiar with one's own mind, developing it, protecting it accordingly, and attaining realization. This is called protecting oneself protects others. So when you protect yourself, when you cultivate your own mind, you become familiar with the contents of your own mind, you develop your own mind, and you protect it, then and attain your realization, you are protecting yourself and thereby protecting others. Again, we'll talk more about this. I'll continue to finish. There's a little more left. It continues, how does protecting others protect oneself? By the gift of fearlessness, the gift of non-violation, the gift of harmlessness. Isn't that beautiful? The gift that we can give to others, protect them, and thereby protect ourselves. By the gift of fearlessness, so that they're not afraid of us. The gift of non-violation, so that we're not aggressive or violate them or harm them. The gift of harmlessness. By having a mind of benevolence and empathy for the other. This is called protecting others, protects oneself. So by protecting others, giving them these gifts of protection, then oneself is protected. When the Buddha had spoken this discourse, the monks, which could be common people like you, who had heard what the Buddha said, were delighted and received it respectfully. I hope you're delighted too. So with that, let's think about the structure of the sutta first. So when the teacher, when the acrobatics teacher first says, "Okay, you watch out for me, I watch out for you, we'll both be protected." Well, that also makes sense. At first, it made sense, right? Because he's a teacher, so he's really watching out for his disciple. Because, after all, so what he has to do is that the teacher on the ground is putting a pole on his shoulder, and the student is up on the pole balancing herself or himself in the sky. So basically, if anything goes wrong, who's going to get hurt? The student, most likely. She's going to be the one injured in smithereen. So it makes sense that in many cases, when we're the more experienced person, perhaps, when we're the more senior person, we're thinking, oh, I need to watch out for my disciple. I'm going to watch out for you so that you don't fall. And okay, you can watch out for me. And this is how we're going to be protected, right? It's the same way that... So does that make sense when you, in a relationship, when you're the older one, you're the more experienced one, you're like, okay, I'm going to watch out for you. And okay, you watch out for me too, and we're both protected. So in that way, that makes sense too. But let's think about it. The teacher, the acrobatics teacher, if he's too concerned about the student up there, could lose his balance, right? Could not actually have good balance, and the student can fall. And if the student is taking so much care of the teacher, and he could lose his balance and fall. So it doesn't really make sense in that way, if you really think about it. So, in the worldly way, it makes sense. So how does this actually make sense for our practice? What is meant by this practice? By the simile, there are two ways to interpret it, and I think the Buddha is very clear in how knowing the contents of your own mind, basically protecting yourself, is to be aware of contents of your own mind. Essentially means mindfulness, to be mindful, to know what's going on in your own mind, to admit to yourself when there is greed, hatred, and delusion. So there is this self-protection by knowing what's going on, instead of going around and condemning others for what they are doing to us, instead knowing what's arising, what's happening in our own mind. So in that way, mindfulness really, really becomes protection. So this became known to me through practice, because, you know, it sounds neat and it sounds interesting. Again, on a recent retreat, there was a time, and as you know, deep practice on retreat is really, really wonderful, because it allows one to see what is possible, to see really what is the extent that of mind being calm and aware and mindful, and what is the extent that the mind can be developed. Of course, coming back home, that may not be maintained, but the perfume, the residue remains in one's practice. So I know that for me, there was a time during my practice, during this retreat, when my mind was really, really calm, really still, and really mindful of everything that was going on. Every thought, every fear, every worry, every dislike, every like. And it occurred to me that's what it meant to be protected in the Dhamma. I felt so safe. I had never felt so safe in my own mind. I felt completely safe because I knew the content, and there was a sense of knowledge and safety and calm and really beauty in the mind, which didn't last, of course, but there was this sense of, wow, I felt so safe. Because mostly when we hurt, we are hurting ourselves. We are causing pain to ourselves, given our thought patterns, given all the fears, given all the obsessions that we have through our day and through our life. This also tied in my mind, with understanding with the practice of metta. So the practice of metta in this tradition, metta, loving kindness. So there are four phrases. The first phrase being, starting with oneself, may I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. Ooh, inner harm. Ooh, guess who's causing that? And this February, I was practicing a metta for a month, and I really connected with this sentence, "May I be safe and protected from inner and outer harm," realizing how much harm I cause myself. I mean, the outer harm is, I mean, there are no meteorites. This is a pretty safe place where there's, you know, there are chances of being run over by a truck are pretty low, and there are no wars, civil wars going on. So outer harm, low. Inner harm, ooh, plenty throughout the day, every minute, every hour. Does that make sense? Yes. So I really connected with this, may I be safe from inner and outer harm, and really connecting with, oh, inner harm. I caused myself inner harm. And knowing that my best protection was mindfulness, to know the contents of my mind. And also the metta practice that I was doing, wishing well for myself, wishing well for others, it seemed like the highest protection to really protect my mind from these bad neighborhoods that it likes to go to and get stuck there, and it's bad. You know what I'm talking about. So really, it's the mindfulness and the metta seemed like the highest protection, and I felt safe again when I was doing the metta retreat. I really felt safe. My mind was happy. My heart was happy. And I also connected with another aspect of practice, which is sila, which is ethical conduct. And it again became so clear to me that if I behave ethically, if I don't say things that hurt people, if I have right speech, if I don't have wrong speech, if I don't steal, if I don't hurt people actively, if I don't take intoxicants, to cause heedlessness, all of these, and the memory of the acts that I've done, I feel protected because I don't have regret. Ooh, I shouldn't have done that. I really shouldn't have said that thing. So there is so much protection that we offer ourselves and we offer other people through our conduct also, our ethical conduct. It just all made sense all of a sudden. So now I'll continue with the simile a little more. And so a few other points that Bhikkhu Anālaya brings up about this about the simile. Actually, there's another simile that he brings up, and it's the simile of the chariot driver. That's the same way that a chariot driver, by maintaining awareness by driving, avoids an accident and protects not only himself and other people. That is the function of mindfulness, by protecting yourself and others, because you're avoiding accidents of the mind, these bad neighborhoods of the mind. You're being aware of them. So he points out that mindfulness, which is what really this sutta is pointing to, has two functions. One is the protective function, protecting ourselves and protecting others. And the other one is sort of a gatekeeper. So the protective function, it prevents the intrusion of evil and promotes wholesomeness in the mind. And the second level, which actually there is a simile of a gatekeeper of a town, where mindfulness is likened to a gatekeeper that will only let in the good people and doesn't let, you know, keeps out the riffraff. And also what it does is that it takes two important people when they show up to the gates, which is tranquility and insight, takes them to the king. So tranquility and insight. So the point of mindfulness is it actually not just keeps the greed, hatred, and illusion, delusion out, but also it really invites tranquility and insight into our experience. And one subtle point about mindfulness as a gatekeeper is that sense restraint, sense restraint is something that is applauded. For example, you don't necessarily if you know, actually, I'll make this relevant. So if you know that if you read news or surf the internet late at night at 11:30 p.m., you're not going to go to sleep. Well, it's better to restrain your senses, right, and not do that. So it's kind of wise not to do it. But sense restraint, nevertheless, is not the path to enlightenment at all. So the point being that you can't just close your eyes and go through life with blinders and not look at places. And you need to be able to have mindfulness to see when greed, hatred, and illusion arise, when you are in the middle of life, when you are interacting with people, when you are reading news that's disturbing or difficult, or when you are interacting with people who make you upset or angry. So you can't just avoid news that's disturbing or people who are disturbing. You are going to be in the middle of it, right? So you can't just have sense restraint, excluding everything. So one simile is that the Buddha, tongue-in-cheek, told the Brahmin practitioner that if avoiding seeing and hearing was the way to enlightenment, then blind and deaf people automatically would have been accomplished practitioners. So just to say that complete self-restraint is not the way to realization, but it has its place. But of course, mindfulness is the key. So a couple of other things I wanted to add before talking about the secrets of great relationships, which I have advertised, so I should deliver. But here, I front-loaded with a little more sutta stuff before I get into the secrets. Is that okay? Just a few more minutes? Yes, okay. You're with me. Okay, good. In terms of protection for others, let me see if this is... Yeah, so in terms of protection... actually, I'm going to read this part from... Nyanaponika Thera, who's also a very accomplished monk. If we ourselves think of nothing else than to crave and grasp, then we may rouse or strengthen these possessive instincts in others. Our own conduct may induce others to join us in the common satisfaction of rapacious desires, or we may arouse in them feelings of resentment and competitiveness. In the end, greed and hate are indeed like contagious diseases. If we protect ourselves against these evil infections, we shall, to some extent, at least also protect others. So this talks about how we protect ourselves and then thereby protect others, because there is contagiousness to greed and hatred. Haven't you noticed? It is contagious. So we do protect others by doing that. He continues to say, he who earnestly devotes himself to moral self-improvement and spiritual self-development will be a strong and an active force for good in the world. I really like that. It's not just about others, but really being a force of good in the world. We can be that. We can aim high. We have to aim high with this practice. We have to. If not us, then who? To be a strong and active force for good in the world. And it starts with our own actions. It starts with our own mindfulness, with housekeeping, what's in the contents of our mind. A little bit about protecting others. Being patient and forbearing towards others, giving them the gift of fearlessness, the gift of non-violation, and the gift of harmlessness. It's actually dana, generosity. It's an expression of generosity, not just to give money and goods and gifts and time, but to give people the gift of fearlessness so they're not afraid of us. The gift of our kindness, of our harmlessness, is the biggest gift we can give them. They feel safe, and thereby we feel safe. because we're interacting with them. So in that way, by protecting others, we protect ourselves. It's less likely that if you're kind to someone, they turn back and are nasty to you. It diffuses kindness. Let's see if I can remember this quote. In the words of the Buddha, hatred never ceases through hatred. It's only through love that it ceases, and it's from the Dhammapada. And it is so true. So I wanted to share a couple of experiences of myself where I both specifically failed to see what was the contents of my mind, and in the case where the gift of giving the gift of loving kindness to somebody else really protected both of us. So I'll give my failure first so that you learn from my mistakes. So this is about 20 years ago when I was at school in Berkeley, and this is before actually I had started to practice in the Theravada tradition. So I wish I had these tools. I so wish I had these tools then. And there was a friend, colleague, who was promoting a topic, in a questionable way, which to me at the time seemed ethically questionable. And I remember being very upset and self-righteous and shouldn't be there this way, he shouldn't be doing this, blah, 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 blah. Oh my goodness, I drove myself crazy, absolutely crazy about what should be done. And since I didn't know what to do, I engaged someone who was more senior and more position of power to sort of figure it out. But anyway, I suffered so much through this. And years and years later, when I had a conversation with this person, I apologized to this person saying, you know what, I don't think I handled that very skillfully or skillfully at all. I should have just had a conversation with him and say, what's going on? This is what I think. What are you doing? Let's talk with a sense of goodwill instead of righteousness. What's wrong with this person? Oh, they're greedy. They're this. They're that. They shouldn't do it. It was terrible. It was just, I was in the prison. I was hurting myself, and I didn't act skillfully, and probably I hurt others too. And what was most interesting, though, which I want to relate to, after I apologized after many years and I brought back the memory of this, he sort of looked at me and said, you know, He couldn't even remember what it was about. And he said, you know, in a very kind way, you know, that, you know, obviously this has been much more on your mind than it has been on mine. Definitely a lesson there. So I hope you learn from my failures. Now, another example of where actually the practice of metta and compassion practice came to my help was about a year ago, more than a year ago. I was in a situation where it was very, very difficult with another person, and very difficult. A lot of anger and was coming towards me. Which was, again, at first I went into like, well, I didn't act out of this, out of that, so kind of justifying myself. And then I took a few days, and then my mind turned to doing compassion practice, both for myself and for this person, really, because I was really hurting with all the anger and negativity that was coming up, and realized that all the anger was because this person was really hurting also, really hurting. So I did compassion for myself, and then I just turned, it just naturally turned to doing compassion for her. And it was actually miraculous. And I'm not saying because it's me, I think it's this practice that is miraculous. And my heart just opened. I could just see the hurt she was going through. And out of this stance, you know, the anger just disappeared. And we were both in this situation together where, you know, she wanted the best. She was scared. She was so scared and upset. And if I were in her shoes, I would be just as hurt and upset and angry. So what came out of that, the action that came out of that wasn't a righteous and angry back. the action that came out was one of generosity that even surprised myself, that I was capable of generosity at the face of so much anger. And that completely, I mean, the next meeting we had just completely transformed when I told her that, you know, the what I was going to do, etc. It was just completely transformed. We were both in tears and crying, and words of love were flowing, whereas in the previous meeting it was just anger and hatred. So this practice is the highest protection, is really the highest protection we can offer ourselves and we can offer others. It's the highest protection there is. There is no other safety net or protection or permanence in the world. There isn't. It's just the contents of our mind. So, since I've promised the secrets of great relationships and there's limited time left, I should get to it. So, I think I'll let this be for now. So the reason why these two topics sort of came together for me, this list of 16 as well as the simile, is it turns out two of the items on the secret of great relationships have to do with taking care of others and taking care of yourself. And feel free, as I talk about this, you can imagine either in your close relationship, partnership, or any other relationship you have in your life, any friendship you have. So one is really about taking care of taking care of yourself, knowing that when you take care of yourself, you are taking care of others. You're protecting yourself, protecting others. And the other one is knowing that when you're taking care of the other person, it's actually benefiting the whole relationship. It's balance. It's improving both of your quality of life. So it was pretty amazing to me that after interviewing 100 great marriages, they came up with this. This is what they have in common. That's what they naturally do. Isn't that cool? They care of themselves. And also when they take care of other person, it's not out of resentment. They know that it's actually improving the relationship. And then when they're taking care of themselves also, they don't feel guilty or unhappy. Oh, I shouldn't be taking this time for myself. I shouldn't be, you know, whatever, taking care of myself. It's the way to enrich, take care of both people. It just, duh, it feels so intuitive now that I read it. So I'd like to share a few other things from this list also that I think are very Dharma related. One is generosity of spirit. And the comment next to it is living from the question, how may I best love you? Imagine asking your partner or your friend, how may I best love you? How can I love you best? What do you need? It's the spirit of metta. It's the spirit of love. Without expecting, without attaching, it's just, how can I best love you? How can I best serve you? Another one is believing eyes. Seeing each other's beauty and gifts and reflecting them back to each other. And to me, that is seeing, again, it's a Dharma theme to me, seeing the other person's beauty, seeing the other person's inner goodness. And we all have that inner goodness. And in successful marriages, relationships, they actively do that. They see each other's inner goodness and they bring that out and they reflect that back. I like this one, humor, playfulness, and fun. And I think that's a good one actually for Dharma practice. Because I think we shouldn't practice with a grim determination of realization or bust. It's, you know, it's having some fun with your practice, having curiosity in your practice, having joy in your practice is a much better fuel than grim determination. It's much more fun to sit long hours or walk when you're having fun, when you're curious, when it's joyous and stuff. I have to do this. I'm in pain, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's a different spirit. So I encourage you, when you sit next, when you practice next, bring in that humor. Make fun of your thoughts. Like, whoa, there it goes again. It's just bring that humor. Bring that joy. Here's a good one. Okay, I'll share two more. High priority. Actually, that's the first one, apparently. Holding the relationship as a high priority in life. I like to say that holding one's practice as a high priority, but these two can be the same because your relationship, not just with your partner, but with other people, can be your practice, and it should be your high priority in life as lay people. Your relationship with yourself should be your high priority in life. Figuring out what's in the contents of your mind, which, by the way, is your relationship to yourself, should be a high priority in life. So, and also treating our relationships, all of them, as our practice, as a way that we can serve both ourselves and others. Okay, I'll share one more. Quality of attention. Really showing up and giving each other undivided attention. Again, quality of attention, presence, being present with the people that you care about, being present in the world, being present with yourself when you're doing something. That quality of attention, really. I've heard that giving someone attention is an expression of love. Isn't it? Instead of, well, are you talking to me? I don't know. So yeah, there are a few more, but I think I'll rest it. And this was, by the way, from a book by Linda and Charlie Bloom, I think it's called The Secret of Great Relationships or something like that. So we have just a few minutes left. If anyone has any thoughts they want to share or question, comments, they're welcome.
In the business world, you know, you have to fire people. Can happen. I mean, actually, probably should be done sometimes, and then it's very difficult, depending on a lot of personal issues, and how you handle that is you know, of course, done as in a loving way, but I've not been able to do it. And I've talked to people about it here before in the group. But I just want to remind people, it's not always loving in the way you usually think it. You know, if you're looking out for the company or if you're looking out for the people in the company and then you have an issue, then you also have to be brave enough to do what's needed to be done. Anyway,
I appreciate you bringing that up, and a couple of thoughts on that. One is actually I'm in conversation with someone to really to come up with ways that one can apply the principles of Dharma in the business world, and what would that manual look like? So exactly in the case of firing people, what would that look like? So if you're interested, come by and talk to me afterwards, and we'll pull you in. So that's one thought. And the other thought is, again, when I think of the concept of compassion and self-compassion, it's not one or the other. It's having compassion for all beings, and oneself is included in all beings. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's including all beings, the benefit of all. And sometimes it's harder than one thinks, right? Because the compassion might seem like fierce compassion, So you have to do something. If you don't let these people go, the whole company is going to go down. Mm-hmm. And if you don't let go of the 20%, the 80% are going to lose their jobs. So overall, it's a compassionate act, but it may not seem compassionate. And the way you do it, of course, makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, let's see. Well, there's just a minute left, and I think that's time enough for us to close our eyes, and join together in a moment of loving kindness and metta for ourselves. Gratitude for ourselves for being on this path, for having come out tonight to really make an effort to align our life with what our intention really is. Offering ourselves gratitude, seeing our own inner goodness. Offering ourselves kindness and appreciation and goodwill to this being that is doing the best he or she can. Also seeing that inner goodness with everyone in this room and offering them our goodwill and kindness, the community of fellow travelers, and extending that sense of goodwill and good wish to all beings everywhere. Just because they exist, they have hopes and dreams, just like us, may they all be happy, safe, healthy and well. May all beings be liberated. Thank you for your kind attention.